Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Let's start with spending a moment thinking about how we change. This isn't an exercise in shame, so we'll be gentle. Think about some of how your interests and ideas have shifted over time. We'll start sort of superficially. What are some bands or music that you used to really be into, and it doesn't matter to you anymore? Or the opposite, whole genres of music you used to hate, and now it's like, that's my thing. Or what are some foods or desserts that you used to get all the time, restaurants you used to just, you had to keep going back, not really interesting to you? Or there were foods that you couldn't stand when you were younger, and now it's like, I want it with every meal. Or maybe a sense of fashion that you had years back, hairstyle, the must-haves, the brands that you identified with, a car, or whatever it was. No shame, it was really important to you. Now it's not. You don't think about that stuff at all. Or again, the reverse, you know. It didn't matter to you, but at this point in your life, you know, maybe the vest looks cool, you know. Maybe it'd be okay if I had the red sports car, whatever. But what are the places that you used to go to and you're like, nah, I don't even think about those places anymore. I used to be really excited about that. Or what are some things that you worked really hard to achieve, but now that stuff's not even on your radar? Doesn't matter to you like it used to. You used to be obsessed, and now you barely think about it. Or again, the reverse. Things didn't used to matter to you, but over the years, you find yourself really drawn to, or driven by, this idea of accomplishing a thing. You give it a lot of mental, physical energy. It started to matter to you. What are the ideas that you used to have? You defended them. And now, you don't think that way at all. You maybe did a 180 on it. Beliefs and attitudes that you grew up with, and you completely let them go, even though they used to maybe be part of your identity. Or it's the opposite. You find yourself now, you hold to and are guided by something that it's completely foreign to a previous version of you. It just makes sense now. Are there grudges that you used to have that you don't have anymore? A previous version of you was almost defined by the hurt that was caused you and who did it. And sure, it did hurt. You're not denying that. But over time, the pain, what happened, why, you file it differently now in your mental filing cabinet. You don't feel hung up on it anymore. I wish that person well. Or people that you hated because you were taught to. And frankly, if what was taught to you were true about those people, like your fear of them might have been sort of justified, but you learned, oh, that's not true. However much sense it used to make to me, I don't feel that way at all anymore. I'm not afraid of that. I don't hate them. That idea feels strange to you now, doesn't it? I want you to sit with these answers with the best you can, a non-judgmental attitude, for just a moment, because in a way, the conclusions of the right now you, depending on the issue, they would seem super strange to a previous you, and vice versa. That previous person's thinking, conclusions, interests, they're very strange to who you are now. And the earlier version of you might even look at present you and be a little threatened or put off by you. You are a stranger to each other. And some of these changes are superficial and small and just, you know, you got older or whatever. A lot of them are like circumstances happened, changed how you think, changed your conclusions. And so I want you to consider the person on either ends of the spectrum. Little ideas that have shifted, completely new conclusions, the whole spectrum. All of that is you. And whether you cringe at it because it's so foreign, or you see all of it as just, this is what it means to be a person. You just live life with the data and the tools and the understanding that you have. All of that belongs. All of it's you. And you were always operating on what made sense to you. Probably always sincerely operating on, this is how it seems to me. Hold these thoughts about yourselves for just a moment. Today I want to talk about something I don't know that I've ever spoken on specifically. Frankly, it's another angle on stuff we talk about a lot, and this is sort of even connected to what we just talked about last week. But I want to tease it out in this specific way because of the moment we find ourselves in, even though I think it fits for any time. And it's certainly not everything that needs to be said, but I think it qualifies at least as the beginning of a good discussion, okay? So Genesis 18, in the front part of your Bible, it presents a story that's considered to be pretty monumentally important for the beginning of Judaism's identity. This is where we are getting to know Abraham and Sarah of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. This is how the tradition first takes shape with Abraham. It says, "The Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looked up and saw three men standing near him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent entrance to meet them and bowed down to the ground. He said, 'My Lord, if I find favor with you, don't pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring you a little bread that you may refresh yourselves. And after that, you may pass on since you've come to your servant.'" So these guys are like, "Do as you have said." That sounds amazing. And so it happens. Now, as it turns out, these three men are not just regular men. They're angelic messengers of some kind. They're aware of the miraculous news regarding Abraham and Sarah becoming parents. They're way too old for such a thing, but they're going to have a child, Isaac, in their old age. Abraham doesn't know anything about them, though, other than they're strangers walking by some hot afternoon. And it says, "The Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre as he sat in the door of his tent on this hot day." This this area where these oaks are is an already established religious site. So when strangers walk by, I mean, they could be anybody from anywhere. They could have a completely different worldview and totally believe totally different things. They may believe and think similarly to Abraham. They could think whatever he believed was idiotic. There's a remote chance that these are people whose beliefs are hostile to Abraham and Sarah and what they believe. Lord, in all caps there, by the way, is God's name. It's not the title Lord. That's God's. We don't know exactly how to say it in the original Hebrew. So this is God's presence appearing. Some translations have it visiting Abraham. God's presence is there that afternoon. Doesn't ask or command anything. It's a statement about divine presence. But here's where it gets sort of tricky, interesting. The second verse says that he, Abraham, looks up, which ancient commentators often understood as a portrayal of Abraham having been meditating, like worshiping, experiencing this mysterious presence of the divine with his eyes closed, his head down or something. But he's interrupted, and so he looks up. And that's when he sees three strangers. And he runs from his tent and says, "My Lord, if I found favor," and you see that Lord here is lowercase because it's a completely different Hebrew term. This is where you get a term more like sir or master. We still use Lord this way, landlord. Sir, if I found favor with you, don't pass by your servant. Let me bring the food and the water, wash your feet, and do that whole thing. So going back well over 1,000 years, you find debates about what's actually being depicted in these couple of sentences. Because it seems like God shows up, but unbeknownst to Abe, God is showing up as, you know, disguised as these three guys. or maybe one of them. You know, it's God and then two others. Abraham doesn't have any idea either way. And that might be what was intended by the original author. And this is the other popular conclusion by sages and rabbis, it's this, that what verse 1 is saying is that Abraham is having this worshipful moment in his tent. He's experiencing the divine presence and has this reverent, head down, maybe eyes closed, worshipful moment happening, but it's interrupted. And he looks up and sees there's three guys standing there. No idea who they are. He runs from the tent to them. He leaves the spot. He's having this experience to tend to these strangers, bringing them into he and Sarah's care. He feeds them, gives them rest, relief, puts them under their protection, because that's what you do. He has no idea who they are other than people who needed some hospitality. Abraham leaves his God moment to care for the strangers. "Hang on, God, I'll be right back. Some people are walking by." The 5th century Jewish writings called the Talmud comments on this scene in Genesis, and here's one of its conclusions. "Welcoming guests is greater than welcoming the presence of the divine." Abraham and Sarah are the headwaters of the Jewish faith, the faith tradition celebrated and upheld by Jesus of Nazareth. And this story spells out how it takes shape. Abraham understanding private devotion is important, but as soon as there's an opportunity to reach out to another person, you do that. To make a stranger feel less strange, a moment where an other can be made to feel less other, welcomed and cared for as they are, private spiritual practice becomes secondary to extending kindness even to somebody you have no clue about. See, Abraham didn't pause or postpone worship then in this view. He looked up, saw an opportunity to offer kindness to unfamiliar people, and then began worshiping when he ran away from the tent to do it. What Abraham then prioritizes, we find out this is what the divine prioritizes. So God essentially says, these two, this is what I'm going to build the whole tradition on. You're old, but you're going to have kids because I want to make an entire people from this attitude, from this spirit. Okay, so right now I need you to meet me over on the tangent cam because I need to say something. Hi, welcome. Abraham is celebrated in this moment in Genesis 18 for his hospitality being prioritized over his private ritualized devotion. The next scene is Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where these divine messengers go to these cities. From Abraham and Sarah's to Sodom and Gomorrah. The next chapter is the famous, albeit not very well read, story of the entire city trying to assault, we'll put it that way, angels as a symptom of what? Their absolute antithetical spirit to Abraham and Sarah's. So we go from heroes of hospitality to villains, horrendous, violent inhospitality. The next story has nothing to do with sex, like lovemaking, sexual orientation, queer love, homosexuality, nothing that's been labeled sodomy over decades, centuries, because of disingenuous readings of the story. The story's a counterbalance to what we just saw Abraham and Sarah doing for these same exact strangers. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. Ezekiel chapter 16 captures God confronting Jerusalem for abominations, which are cruelties, injustices, excesses at the expense of others, things like idol worship and deceit and murder, ripping people off, toxic self-centered behavior. Those are all abominations. And so God is saying to the city of Jerusalem this: this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were conceited and had excess of food and prosperous ease, but they didn't aid the poor and needy. They were arrogantly superior and did abominable things before me. Therefore, I removed them when I saw it. So when we talk about the sin of Sodom, we should be doing it like Ezekiel did, like God does in Ezekiel. The sin of Sodom and why God destroys it in this story was because people were desperately violent and evil and abusive and cruel. It's not because they were pride parades. No matter how many times those dudes hold the stupid signs up saying otherwise, the whole story of inhospitable violence is a counterweight to the story right before it, Abraham and Sarah's beautiful, loving hospitality. Okay, let's return to the main thought. So what does Abraham and Sarah's hospitality have to do with us? A lot. A lot if we're trying to get love right when it's difficult, but a lot for those of us who know what it's like to have friends and family members, former church people who they were so devoted to God, they ignored everything else, that their faith was why they mistreated and abandoned and neglected other people, maybe us. Some of us know what it's like for somebody to say they had to choose God over you. In fact, maybe it's something you once thought you had to do. You believed it was your religious duty to defend your faith against people, to protect the walls of your faith tradition, even as doing so created pain out for those outside the walls of your beliefs. Maybe you learned the hurtful idea that true faith makes it necessary to turn your back on other people sometimes, their lives, their beliefs, because they're strange. And so you got to choose God over people. And this is why some of us have so easily elevated the inhospitable faith that we're part of to inhospitable nationalism, Christian nationalism. Because it comes from this same small, anxious spirit that says other people have to become what I am in order to be loved and cared for and included and celebrated equally. Foreigners of faith, strange, different Bible interpretations or completely non-biblical religions, foreigners, they're sort of on a continuum as like foreigners to our country. You're not one of us, so you're to be regarded as dangerous to us and in a very real way less than us unless you become us. That's bad religion, and it metastasizes to the national scale. And this bad religion can live in all of us. But Abraham and Sarah force a reconsideration. What if reverent, divinely saturated moments found in sacred music or prayer or all those wonderful things that happen inside the tent of our space, what if all that's secondary? And sometimes not even secondary. What if that can be a hindrance to the real stuff, to what the Spirit of God is actually after? What if making space for the foreign person, the foreign idea, what if that's greater than defending what I believe to be right and pure doctrine? What if on the more societal scale, what if welcoming the stranger is more important than what I maybe think of as patriotism? What if welcoming the stranger is greater than welcoming the presence of the divine? This is probably why throughout the gospel accounts, where we watch Jesus' life and ministry, we just don't see Jesus explaining what legitimate worship services look like, or which worship songs are the most important, discussing which things in somebody's personal life are the pure or impure, or who to shun because of their religion or the country they're from, or how they seek to love and to live. Jesus doesn't do those things. I mean, read the whole Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. There's not a single sentence in there about correct belief or doctrine in the traditional sense. It's the kind of life that you live in others' midst. There's no how to weed people out based on their differing conclusions. We don't see Jesus ever refusing to make space for another person because he wants to protect the tent of his own religion or comfort or anything like patriotism. We see a whole bunch of scenes in the Gospels, somebody welcoming Jesus or not welcoming Jesus or hesitant to welcome Jesus. And the result is learning the extent to which Jesus welcomes, creates space for others, even and perhaps especially those not welcomed by others, especially those most religious and devout. The fundamental expression of Christ's love in the New Testament seems to not happen in something like a church service or somebody properly understanding an argument about theology. It happens in an opened home or in public where somebody has made space for somebody else as they are. And the truth of God's love is illuminated in the process. And you already know, if you've never read the Gospels, you still sort of know this. I bet if you think back to a fond childhood memory of a teacher or somebody like that, the memory isn't rooted in what you learned from a lesson or curriculum. The good news in that memory was probably you feeling like this teacher had space for you. Not just the physical classroom. There was room in their time and their attention, their mind and their heart for you. You felt heard and seen when you didn't feel that way in other places. You already know the beauty, the magic of this. And so maybe this kind of thing helps us understand that we're not, when we talk about hospitality, we're talking about a spirit, a posture of being able to offer space, not literally being good hosts for guests in a physical space, although I hope you're good at that. Sometimes people will put it meeting people where they're at. And I think that gets at some of this. Like if you really get good at meeting people where they're at, it gets at this spirit of hospitality, learning to recognize I have resources in me available for others. I have access to an attitude that says, I can offer room for you as you are, in which I would serve you as you are, rather than trying to create a space to get you to serve me by conforming to my views. And this is my whole faith. This hospitality, this way of hospitality can be your whole faith because it describes this inspired strength that I'm becoming more and more aware of that allows me to make room for differences because I am willing to see that we're fundamentally in the same family. We're fundamentally the same. Underneath all of our ideas, which aren't us, we're fundamentally the same. And I am contributing to healing this illusion of separateness between us. There's some interesting things happening in some words that we're using. In Romans 12, for instance, Paul tells his friends, let your love be genuine. Hate what, not who, hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with mutual affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. And he loves his lists. And the last thing in this train of thought, he says, contribute to the needs of the saints, pursue hospitality. So help out with your fellow saints, people who are like you, they're in this with you, of course. And at the same time, pursue hospitality. Now, hospitality is an interesting word in the biblical Greek here. It's philoxenia. I'm probably butchering that, but if you break it down, you can see it. Philo, which means that friendly, warm love, and xenia, which is not only the name of a town I grew up in and around, but it comes from a root word, xenos, which means foreigner. So hospitality, this word, it means stranger love, love of stranger. And you might notice xenos is the same word in xenophobia, which is the opposite of biblical hospitality, because it's a prejudicial, fear-based otherizing that endangers the foreigner and the stranger. It endangers the other. Xenophobia, you can think of as like the evil twin of hospitality, because rather than drawing them in to belong as they are, it casts all of our anxieties on them. And sometimes it does so to stir up others' fear and disgust so we can have a common enemy. It makes me feel closer to people who are already in my tent, so because all of those negative feelings have to go somewhere. Frankly, if you want to evaluate whether or not a nation is a Christian nation, ask how its leaders, the people who have power, how they speak of foreigners, aliens, strangers. What do they accuse them of doing? What do they say should happen to them? what law rules and guides these decisions? I believe on this basis alone, you can answer whether a nation is Christian or if it's simply just another nation that may have a Christian vocabulary. Also consider this. The author of 1 Peter thought that the world was going to end, apparently literally, thought it's all over any day now. I don't even know if I'll get to finish this letter. And so here's how the author speaks. At one point saying, "The end of all things is near. Therefore, be serious and discipline yourselves for the sake of your prayers," which certainly makes sense. And Abraham certainly was into it. And then he says, "Above all, maintain constant love for one another, for love covers a multitude of sins, and be hospitable. Practice stranger love," it's the same word, "to one another without complaining." The end is coming. Well, don't go hide in your apocalypse bunker and vilify and scapegoat others, and strangers, foreigners. Get busy loving your friends and family and make sure everybody has a chance to belong. Now is the time to do that. While everybody else is behaving desperately, anxiously, self-preservingly, living on the terms of scarcity and exclusion and suspicion, even as the meteor seems to be heading our way, we, above all, are consistently loving one another and making sure that those deemed other, stranger, get a chance to be fully included, if at all possible, if that's what they want, as though we were including Christ himself. This is super, super challenging stuff. This is why most of us prefer worship, doctrine, beliefs, all that stuff, because it's just easier. It's safer. Let the strangers pass by. Let's just argue about what the Bible says. It's always been blatantly challenging because it's extraordinarily counter to the way most of us have been raised, if we've been raised in the ways of fear, which most of us have been. And perhaps it's so counter, that's what makes it attractive, almost like sexy. It's alluring to be invited into something that seems so profoundly different, even idealistic. But I have to tell you, once the church service is over and you and I get back into the real world and realizing how this actually looks in a world full of difficult, wrong-headed, and often hurtful people, the momentum toward just remaining inhospitable, uncharitable and suspicious and exclusive, avoidant but still religious, the momentum of those attitudes, it's super, super hard to resist. Because the person who's going to say something rude to you or about you today or this week, that's who we're talking about here. They're probably not a stranger. They're somebody you work with or are related to. They're not a stranger that way. Their ideas, their conclusions, that's what's foreign. That's what's alien and strange. And so how do we in real time make space for that, with all the feelings that comes with it? Well, you might not have to. I should say that. You might just decide that their lack of peace doesn't have to be your lack of peace. That is an option. I don't think we choose it enough. It's often the smart one. It's a hard thing to listen to somebody and make space for somebody when you know already they're wrong-headed. They're committed to not understanding anybody but their own words. It's a hard thing to listen to someone when you know what they really need to do is just shut up and listen for once. That's hard. But we have to ask the question, how does the spirit of hospitality invite me right now to make space for a person when I can tell the outcome is still going to be disagreement? And what I think is being willing to ask the question, how do I make space for this person right now? I think that gets us almost all the way there. Having the presence of mind to go out of your tent with even just a bit of curiosity to say, can strangers unstrange themselves right now? The willingness and presence of mind might be all it takes for something magic to occur when otherwise it would have just been, you know, leave me alone. The willingness to say, I wonder if I made a little bit of room for the whole person, offered the wholeness of their humanity some space in the shade of my hospitality. Would that give love a chance to do something? To de-escalate things, to patch up things, to make things better, to increase understanding, to increase the chance that our actual humanity will come into view far more brightly than the, you know, our conclusions and our beliefs, because that's not who we are. What we really are underneath is underneath that. The willingness to say, I wonder if, despite this feeling in me of irritation, disappointment, disgust, an impulse to push away or to shut out or to lay into. I wonder if instead I made some room to understand if I wouldn't at least end up seeing their side of things. Aristotle famously said, it's the mark of an educated, enlightened mind to be able to entertain, to host a thought without accepting it. These are some of the ways hospitality could be attempted. The love of a stranger, the love of someone who maybe isn't actually, I know their face. I've known them for a long time, but they're in possession of strange, foreign, alien ideas. These are some ways that maybe we could step toward each other rather than just at each other or away from each other. But then maybe the hard thing to make space for is not this. It's something beyond this. It's not somebody whose views are just annoying and different. They aren't just mocking and belittling our ideas or our beliefs. They belittle our existence. Maybe they're dangerous to you or to those that you love. How do you make space for that without enabling or becoming a doormat? I don't know. I could pretend to, but I'm just realizing I don't know. There are many instances where I don't think you should try, regardless of what somebody, you know, makes the Bible say to the contrary. I don't think it would be good for you. I don't think it'd be wise or helpful. And here's an important point. I say all this aware I'm a generally financially secure, able-bodied, straight white man. So whatever I'm saying about this, I say one is somebody who, one, can offer a different space than many of you, but I inhabit space differently than many of you. So let me also say that I'm not taking my cues about all this from straight white dudes. Best I can, I'm trying to take them from Jesus of Nazareth, a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew who lived under the heel of power. I'm not bringing you stuff from Caesar. I'm trying to bring you stuff from Jesus, from Paul, a persecuted minority. I'm trying to take my cues over these last years more and more from black and brown voices in our own time, from women who speak and write with incredible moral, ethical force, from queer siblings who have been beaten into the corners of our society by legislation and by literal fists. But they keep bouncing back as icons of love and justice and moral seriousness and grace. These are the voices I'm learning hospitality from. How we can radiate the strength of kindness in a world that would seem way more willing to reward bitterness, division, violence, or self-erasure. Keep your head down. I mean, frankly, these are the voices that made space for me. They were hospitable to me. And because of that, I came to see and know things and feel things I would have never known had they just reasonably zipped up their tent and let me walk by. These voices made space for me oftentimes. And they show me still today where hospitality just isn't, it's not wise. I mean, Jesus walked on water and still said, yeah, offer peace to people, but if they're not worthy of it, take it back. There's nothing you can do. Move on. So hear me when I say, it's not hospitality to offer your house to an unrepentant arsonist. It's not hospitality to give rest to those who will use their strength to harm. It's not hospitality to insist on unity because you're so uncomfortable with division. That it's not hospitality to insist the wounded and those who wounded them get along. But please hear this too. We have to be really good at knowing the difference between not agreeing with somebody and them being evil. The difference between being disappointed and frustrated and angry with someone and even hurt by them, and then them being wicked, a lost cause who wish people harm. We got to be the best at discerning these kinds of things, because the alternative is just zipping the tent shut and then believing our labels, lumping everybody together. People like that, they're toxic, they're evil, they're haters, on and on and on. I think a lot of us are putting more energy into labeling people and problems than we're putting energy into finding ways to make space for everybody it's possible for. And I do understand this, because when we're hurt, zip the tent. I get that. Yet, the invitation of wisdom and compassion, challenging as it is, invites us to make space however we can, even when it stings, even when it's hard. So an example I'll offer is, I won't bring my queer kid to your Thanksgiving dinner if you're homophobic, if you think Project 2025 is awesome. I won't do that. Even if you said, no, I love everybody. I wouldn't have you over to the house when my kid was there. Why? I'm not trying to be a jerk. Love. But I would also, because of love, I would be willing to try to find a way to make space for you. Outside of that being detrimental to anybody that I loved, I would share relational space for you. I would hear you out and understand best I could, and hopefully be heard and understood by you in that space that I am willing to create. Because I know if I offer best I can relational shelter, hospitality to you, I am creating a possibility for love to heal what needs to be healing, to enlighten what needs to be enlightened, to rejoin what needs to and can be rejoined. I am making space for the world to improve for you and for me and for you and me and for my kid and for your kid and on and on and on. I am trying to wisely participate in hospitality that way. And I don't mean to make this sound like, you know, just here are the sales techniques for tricky customers. It's way weightier than that. And I really do know this isn't for everybody. And frankly, the timing is tough. This is a little hard to take on board right now. I just feel compelled to say that this is for more of us than I think we realize. Remember how Paul said, love must be sincere, hate what is evil. And then he said, practice stranger love, hospitality. Do you know the very next thing that he said? Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. Like, make space for whatever mood you're encountering and honor it. Live in harmony with one another. But what about people who refuse to live in harmony with me or my loved ones? Perfect question. I'm glad I imagined you asking it. Let's keep going. Don't be arrogant. Don't be willing to associate with people of low position. Don't be conceited. Don't repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. Well, geez, what if what seems right to somebody isn't actually right? Perfect question. Very smart. If it is possible, because it won't be. This is a huge if. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Don't take revenge, my dear friends. Leave room for God's wrath. Like, let God sort that stuff out, because then there's no regret or shame in that. For it is written, it's mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, says Paul, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you'll heap burning coals on his head, which is a 2,000-year-old way of saying kill them with kindness. Be the loving ammonia cap for the goodness asleep within them. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I don't think all of us can do this. I don't know that Paul did it consistently. I'm just telling you that this is what's out there inviting us all the time. Because this is what Paul said about enemies and evil people. How much more then does it apply to us who... we're not being asked to do this for evil people and enemies. It's maybe family members and coworkers. It's people in our apartment and our cul-de-sac. How much more are we challenged here? If he's talking about dangerous, in his time, dangerous enemies, how much more are we being challenged to engage lovingly with those who probably most of the time are neither evil nor actual enemies who want to do us harm? Some of them do. That's different. But there's something between those people and those who want to do us harm. We're talking about people who, it's somewhere on a spectrum of they've came to a different conclusion and they're dead wrong, but they're not evil. We've got to be the best at knowing that. Because there's nothing good for us to gain as a people, communities, society, our nation, from just lumping everybody together that irritates us and then zipping our tent shut. We've got to be the best at knowing the difference between disappointing and frustrating and seeking to do harm. And so if you voted this way, then you are cut off. Please be careful with that. Please be careful with that, because how do we justify such a sweeping thing like that when some of us suffered firsthand? If you believe this about God or the Bible, you're cut off. And I know those aren't exactly the same, but it's worth taking a step back so that we don't become the problem we want to see solved. So we're not overcome by evil, but instead we overcome evil. And then all the stuff that's way shy of evil with good. So we instead see if we can make room. Making room sometimes is just being willing to be curious. For instance, okay, wait a minute. What if these people hold this completely stupid view? Because several smart people made a great case for it. And they genuinely hold this because it just makes a lot of sense. What if they voted that way out of financial desperation? Have you ever been financially desperate? I mean, I have for a little bit, but then financially desperate and you have kids. What if they voted that way simply on, we have to try something different financially? What if they believe that thing because it's tied to an incredibly powerful experience? It's all lumped together. What if they are acting in love best they understand? Like they're sincerely trying to do the most loving thing that they can. They're just coming to a completely different conclusion than I did about what the loving thing is. Like, even if you disagree completely, and you probably will, you can at least see that, well, this isn't evil, and it's not even dangerous per se. It's just foreign, fundamentally foreign. It's a foreign idea strolling up in the heat of the day, as deserving maybe as a cup of water and a piece of bread as anyone. You don't have to agree. You should disagree and find a way to do so honorably, intelligently, but hospitably. Like I said, I don't think this can work every time. And I don't know fully how it is supposed to work and where the line, I don't know. No one person does. We just have to be willing to do this together, to speak into this as a community, diverse backgrounds and all that stuff, so we can figure out what hospitality can and should look like and what it shouldn't. We have to speak into this together and listen to each other, because our goal is to get it right. So trust me when I tell you, I am no less trying to do this imperfectly in every concentric circle of relationships in my life. And I bet in some way that describes you. So if you can't imagine doing this yet, all I would ask then is that you and I look around today and say, well, at least we know we can't just zip up the tent over these next months and years and pretend things will get better if all we do is master guarding space more than making space for everybody that we can make space for. So when you're ready to ask the question, okay, well then how do we make things better in our own circles and then on the broader societal stage, how do we make things better? I think this is going to be the answer. The spirit of hospitality, which will take different shapes for us all, but we will be learning how to implement this strength, this posture that says, I have the resources to extend room for more thoughts and feelings of others that I disagree with than I think I give myself credit for. Together, I think that we have this well to draw from to make space for others more than I think I previously understood. Stranger love, that we're going to be able to do that. Building relational shelters best we can, every time we can, for people whose thoughts and beliefs and views and conclusions are just completely alien to our own. Because even in our own lifetime, we have changed our own minds about some stuff, interests and beliefs, from the superficial preferences and tastes all the way to how we treated other people. Even we are strangers and aliens to our former selves. And we did all of that sincerely. And so as we close, I want us to be reminded of a theme that pops up in the scriptures. The stranger who resides among you shall be to you as the native born among you. You shall love the strangers and aliens as yourself, for you were strangers and aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Obviously, this has literal wait for the time we find ourselves in, for our dear siblings who are labeled immigrants, especially brown immigrants, and what is packed into these terms like illegal and undocumented and mass deportation. These texts speak directly to that, and we've got to get it right as people of love, as citizens, as people of faith. All we have to get it right. But also, texts like these speak to another, perhaps more fundamental truth. You're a stranger. You and I are strangers. You know what it's like to be alien, to not belong, to be the oddball, the outsider, to sincerely believe a thing, and that what you're saying and doing is right and true, or at least it's totally well-intended, and for it to not be received in one way or another, you know what it's like. You and I may have not been in ancient Egypt, but we know what it's like to be the stranger, the outcast. And so once again, we are saying yes, best we can, to an invitation to love others the way we want to be loved, as is. And as one willing to change and grow, if somebody would make room for me to be able to do that, to take as much hostility and mocking and shame out, and to give space for me to sit under the shade of understanding, I'm likely to change my mind about something. My friends, whether offering sincere prayer from a safe distance, because that's all you should do, to engaging directly the absolutely unfamiliar, but making space and kindness that you may not get back in return, best we can, we're saying yes to an invitation to love as we want to be loved. May we together see ourselves drawing from a bottomless well of love and kindness and wisdom and courage in an anxious, troubled world. In Christ's name, amen.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.